Come on, who am I interviewing today?
You're interviewing Sister Monique Flippo, known as Sister Nikki. Since we started using our first names. Nikki, because I was always Nikki, because I had two older little sisters, and Monique was too much of a handful, and so I was called Nikki. And back in the late 60s, I started being interested in families who had a child who didn't fit into the normal schooling, and felt that we, as an educational order, should be doing something about that. And I found that Sister Nikki was a good name, so I have adopted that as my name, because it's me. Monique's just a little bit too I don't know. It's a little bit uppity. So who am I and where do I come from? I was born on the harbour side on the Lane Cove River at home of French parents. And that has been a tremendous richness. It also was difficult as we were growing up because I was born in 1924. And being at school pre-war and during Second World War, the Frenchies were not terribly popular at that time. So we learnt to live with that, and we learnt to appreciate the fact that we had two nationalities. And my father was very French and had fought right through the First World War. So we valued that part of our tradition, but he loved being in Australia once he'd started living here, and he loved going back. He was like a little schoolboy going home when he had the opportunity to go back to France. So we picked up that too, and I've been to France a number of times. We went to school at the Sacred Heart. We should have gone to Loretto because we were on that side of town, us little girls. But my mother had an uncle who was a priest, and he came to the 1928 Congress. He was staying at King Coppell, Elizabeth Bay. And he thought the Sacred Heart nuns were wonderful, and there were French nuns there. And so he said to my mother and father, "You will send your little girls to King Coppell." So we trudged all the way across the other side of town and spent all our schooling at King Coppell. And that was a very loving experience. I didn't exactly love school, but I loved the atmosphere, and I certainly got my vocation while I was there, and from quite a young age, that was what I wanted to do. I wanted to have time to be with God. I mean, you know, I was very innocent in those days, thought that if you were a nun, you had lots more extra time. Well, you did in a kind of a way, but I've...
So around what age was that, when you were got that awareness?
I was aware of it my first communion day. I just knew that was it. And then, of course, I thought, oh, my goodness, no, you know, that's... not at all what I want. I'm going to get married and have lots of kids. And, but deep down, I knew. And so because it was wartime, when you got to be 18, you either went into the workforce, and it was 1942, so the war was going to go on for years and years and years, possibly. And so I was faced with the decision to enter before my 18th birthday, or to just postpone it indefinitely. And I decided that it was as worthwhile a thing to do as anything else. And so on the eve of my 18th birthday, I turned up at the novitiate, which was in Melbourne at the time.
Can you describe that process? pretend I know nothing about what that means.
Yes. Well, I suppose it's like you get the sort of feeling that you're being invited, or that's how I saw it, to do this. And I remember being very strongly feeling, not everybody gets this feeling and this invitation. So I saw it as a great privilege. And then I talked about it with the nuns, and they thought it was a good idea. And then my parents, I remember telling my parents about it. There was a bit of something, because I was the first chick to leave the nest, and there were six of us. I was the third. And I told my mother, when we were going into town to buy a new winter overcoat. And I said to Mum, I said, "Now, this has got to be a really nice overcoat, because it's the last overcoat I'll ever have." As I proceeded to tell her. And then I told Dad. And we used to have benediction at the little parish church on Sundays. Not every Sunday, but he used to like to trudge up to benediction. And they would sing Faith of Our Fathers. And my father was very musical. And he, it was still in the days of Latin, which was great, because he was brought up in France, and he liked the Latin. He wasn't at all interested in the English version of everything, but he would come home humming to himself Faith of Our Fathers, you know, all the way home. And I remember this day he was on about Faith of Our Fathers, and I said, you know, told him. And he was very proud, you know. I had parents who were supportive about it, but he thought I was much too young, so they started, you know, going to meet the superiors and talking to them. And anyway, because of the government regulations of the time, it was decided that yes, they would go along with allowing me to enter. Not a good idea from my experience, because you need to have a good deal more maturity, particularly in those days, because it was almost like going back into boarding school.
Can you describe the ceremony, the first ceremony?
The first thing is you just live there for 6 months with the other novices, and we were called postulants. And there was a young woman from New Zealand who was entering the same time as I was. And that is just to be looked at and to get to see what the life is. And we didn't wear a habit or any sort of sign of that. We were just there with the others. And then after 6 months, you were accepted or not accepted to receive the habit. And then there was a sort of a bridal ceremony of receiving the habit. And then followed 2 years of training. The first year was mostly spiritual training. And we did manual work and a lot of sort of embroidery and a lot of that, but also a lot of helping with the manual work in the school.
Where was this at?
And this was at Rose Bay, because we went back to from Melbourne to Rose Bay. They were missing the work that the novices did in the school.
Can you describe some of the work you actually did, and the needlework? Was that with the what?
Well, especially when we were down in Melbourne, because in Melbourne they weren't used to having us, so they didn't know what to do with us, and we made vestments, and we did the most beautiful embroidery. And I loved that, you know, that was absolutely up my alley. Except that the novice mistress, she knew that I loved it. So she would give me a piece of embroidery. We made the most beautiful album. It was all divided up into bits, and we all had bits. And so she would give me one bit, and then I would sort of tidy that up, because other people weren't quite as nifty, and then she would take it away and give me another one. So I never got to actually.
Where did you learn such needlework? Did you?
Well, I learnt at home and at school, and I always loved knitting. I learnt knitting from my grandmother before I went to school, and she lived next door. She was very French, and granddad, on my mother's side. And mum was a great sewer and dressmaker and made things. It was a nice thing to do in those days. So after that year, we started some teacher training, and we started working in the school. And I at Rose Bay, and I couldn't control the children, mainly because I didn't want to. I thought they were lovely kids, and I wasn't going to bully them around. I hadn't entered the convent to be a policeman, and so I used to get into trouble. They used to get into trouble, it was.
How did you deal with that trouble? Did you just shrug it off? How did that impact you?
I taught French. Oh well, it. I was fairly miserable about it. I was fairly miserable because the teaching didn't come easily to me, and there was never enough time to do proper preparation. And so you'd be told that you haven't prepared the lesson properly, and I'd say, well, you know, I didn't have time to. By the time you'd taken the kids to recreation and looked after them in the dormitory, and I was not quick about it all. So I taught people like Betty McMahon and, you know, Anne McGrath, and these people at various times.
I worked with Anne McGrath, can you believe that, in the 80s?
Did you?
But anyway,
aside from that.
I didn't mean yes. Yeah, yes. I did. I can't think of... That may not be right. She was a nun, was she?
Oh, yes. She's the provincial now.
Oh, yeah, no, not her. Sorry, there's somebody else that was at Rose Bay with Betty. Anyway, I'll think of her name later. So can you describe a typical day for you in terms of your prayer and just what time that day would start?
The prayer was the marvellous part of it all because...
Can I get you to say that again? I think I cut in.
Yeah, okay. The prayer was the best part of the day because... there were set times of prayer. You had to fit them in too. We were supposed to have an hour of meditation in the morning. So you got up at about 4:45. Now, that was all right in the novitiate because you had the time set out for it. But once you were working in the school, the young ones were all sleeping in dormitories. And so you had to sort of fit that in before you woke the children, and you'd kneel, you know, beside a little table there with a candle, no electric light or anything like that, and try to pray for an hour. And then the next thing was 1/4 hour of office before Mass, and then Mass, which was usually at about 7:30, something like that. And a quick breakfast, and you were off to school. Then there was 1/2 hour of prayer, which was adoration before the Blessed Sacrament, and you fitted in a rosary, and you fitted in some spiritual reading, sometimes mostly with the community. So that was 1/2 hour, and we all did some sort of sewing while somebody read that. And because I knew French, I often used to read either in French or translating it as I went along, the Lives of Our Mothers, which were written in French. So that needed a bit of preparation. Then you might have a recreation with the kids. That was good. And try to fit in a little bit of correcting of your work and preparation. And after tea, there'd be a bit of 1/2 hour of recreation with the nuns. We'd all just sit around and chat. And they were always presided by the people sort of in charge of that convent. So you didn't speak out of turn. But I very soon got a name, and there were a couple of people who would sit up there, and I'd get a glint in my eye, and that used to get picked up by a couple of them, you know, and they'd say, so, you know, that sort of give me the nod. And that was a great, a good thing for me, because I wasn't acknowledged for anything else, except I could read well in the refectory. I had a good, strong voice, and I did that well. But otherwise, I was not a success. And then you make your first vows. Now you sort of ask, and you write to Rome, and you do all those things, and then they have to accept you. And because in those days it took a while for the message to get there, you know, you'd sort of wait around and think, you know, I'm due and I haven't been accepted, and am I going to be accepted, and all this kind of thing. So eventually it happened, and I made my vows, which is a very solemn sort of thing, and that was my saying that I wanted to go on with this life. And I was not sort of finally accepted until 5 years later, when you become professed, and then you make a final commitment for life.
What time was that?
That would have been 1945. So it was just before the end of the war, and I was immediately, in the middle of winter, sent down here to Kerevere Park, where they used to send the raw little nuns. And that was good in a way, because this was a nice human place. It wasn't an institution. But it was pretty tough, because the idea was to give the young nuns a bit of a tough time, you know. So I spent 6 months at Kerevere Park. And because I was not making a great success of the teaching, I was sent back to Rose Bay and did some more teacher training. And I spent 2 years there working in the school and doing some more training. And then I suddenly got sent up to Brisbane. I spent 2 years there. And that was quite a tough time.
Whereabouts
for
in
me?
Brisbane?
At Stewart Home, which was a boarding school, and the children there had just come back from being at Southport during the war, and they were not knuckling down to, you know, living the normal boarding school life at all. So, and they were full of life, and they were absolutely gorgeous, and so we were all in really real trouble there, myself and the class. But anyway, that's all right. So that lasted 2 years, and I was sent back to King Copland and had 6 lovely months back at my old school, and then I was accepted for profession to go to Rome for 5 months. And I was in floods of tears, because I thought, you know, I'm making a jolly mess of this, and here am I going to be professed for life.
What does that mean?
What did it mean? Well, it meant that I felt I had a vocation to spend my life, you know, in the service of the church, of the love of God, of making known the love of Christ, and I loved the Society of the Sacred Heart, but I didn't feel I was doing a decent job at all. However, I had a wonderful superior at the time, and I went to Rome. And that was a breeze, because they spoke French, and I thoroughly enjoyed that. And I said to myself, right, well, this is where I belong, and that's that, and we'll see what happens. And so that was a beautiful time. of prayer and meeting the church. We were enclosed, so we only went out four times to St. Peter's and the other major churches, and met people from all over the world, 40 of us. And when I came back, we were given our obedience, that's called, where you were going. And guess who? Where I was sent? Back here. Back to Kirribee Park. Anyway, that only lasted for a year. Then I spent some time in Melbourne, and they put me in looking after the children's clothes and that sort of thing. And I taught needlework, and I had dormitories and did that for a while. And from there, I was very practical, I got sent back up to Brisbane to Stuart Home to take charge of all the domestic part of the house. So I was what we now call matron. And I did that well, but it was a lot of work and big staff and a difficult superior who, I suppose she was training me too. I was all of 30. So I spent 7 years there.
That must have been a difficult time.
It was a very difficult time.
Can you talk about how you coped? Like, what coping mechanisms did you draw from? What strength did you draw from?
I coped because there were a few nuns whom I was good friends with, and you know, we used to chat about it, and the this well-known superior, she to whom I was related by marriage, so she. This is really only for you. This isn't something that you say, but it's really rather fun. Now, when she got too tough on me, I would say, "Well, I do believe that my father and mother are coming up to visit me very shortly, right?" And that's all I had to say. And then she'd be nice to me for a while because she loved my dad, and my dad really liked her. She was a very strong, wonderful woman and a person who suffered, and she did a wonderful job. She was an administrator and great spiritual director, but she was tough on the younger nuns. And I had all these wonderful sisters sort of under me, and I was like the meat and the sandwich, you know, the buffer state. And I got to love these absolutely fantastic women, and they taught me so much. I was all right, you know. I mean, I prayed. It was meant to be tough, and it was tough. And then where did I go to from there? Then because I'd done a decent job of it there, I was sent to tidy up Sancta Sophia College, which was in a mess from the domestic point of view. And so I enjoyed that because that was just the time of the Vatican Council. And Sancta Sophia was a hotbed of the young priests and of the thought of the church, new thought of the church in Sydney. So that was great. But while I was there, I sort of suddenly realised, look, you know, I shouldn't be under this sort of pressure that I have been living under. It is not right. There is something not right in religious life. And I broke down. I didn't lose my mind, fortunately, but I had a nervous breakdown. And in those days, if you had a nervous breakdown, you were told by the good Catholic doctors that you had no vocation and you were out. And I was not going to be out, whatever happened. And because I was not in school, and I had a staff who were working really well with me, and I could just disappear and do very little work as long as I made sure everything was okay at that time, because I had the whole place running well. I survived. That has been an enormous strength. It's not something one would wish on my worst enemies, but it is possible to work through it. And with very little help. And I won't go into all the details, but it took some years. And I came back here, and then I was sent down to Melbourne and back into the school at Braybrook, which was in the western suburbs of Melbourne, and had 2 years there. And then I was sent to New Zealand for a short time. But what happened there was two things. One, I realised that nothing could happen to me that would be worse than what had happened, and I had survived. And I survived because I thought, look, all my ancestors went through all these wars in France, and, you know, I said, they've all survived. They're all still living their lives. My father had gone through the whole of the war, and a lot of his family had died. So you've got it, Nikki, you keep at it.
New Zealand, two things.
Yes, I was only in New Zealand for 7 months because when I was down at Braybrook and when I went to New Zealand, I had been out of the school for 15 years and out of ordinary teaching. And I went back into ordinary teaching and I was horrified with what was going on in the school system because everybody was teaching the curriculum and we were not teaching the kids anymore. And so all the ones who couldn't cope with the curriculum were just falling behind. And so I remember asking the supposedly top educators, nuns in charge, principals and so on, or mistress of studies, and what do I do with these kids? And they didn't know. And so I reported back, I didn't think this was good enough. You know, we were supposed to be good educators. So this is important because this is how I came to Sadler. Just at that time, the provincial was asked by a friend of hers if she had anybody who would like to do a course at the Balmain Teachers College for what they call subnormal children. And this was teachers who were working in special schools that were being started up. And there were a lot of people there who had no training at all. Now, this was not what I had in mind. What I had in mind was remedial reading and all that kind of thing. So I spent 3 days thinking about this, and I thought, right, I was about 45 or so, and I was due to go to university because I'd never been to university, and I had applied and I had been accepted and all this, and then this came up. And I thought, right, Nikki, now do you go to university? You know you're not a terribly good teacher. You're a good educator. You know what it's all about, but you're not good at doing it. You've been through this horrific experience, so you understand what it's like not to be able to express yourself and to be an underdog. So I said yes, and I came back to Sydney and did the course. And I've had a ball ever since, working in that field. We had a very good teacher who was running the course, and it was basic education. And we went to a lot of schools, and we really had an overview of the whole of special education, both OA children, which were the very bright ones, and the least bright ones, and we did some 3 weeks of what you call that thing, you know, when you sort of spend time there, work experience in schools. Yeah, and I just could do it, and And then I found that the teachers in the schools and the parents that I met, you're a sister, we're still in the habit. What we want from you is, what do we do about the faith of these kids? The churches and priests don't know what to do, and they're not accepted in the church. And so I went home and reported that. Anyway, I had to go somewhere after this year, we were just getting started here at Sadler, and I asked Betty McMahon if I could come down and have a look at her kids, and I could see all these little nippers who would benefit from the basic learning techniques that I had learned. And I said, well, that's what I was really looking for. And in the meantime, I'll try to find out what's going on church-wise. And Father Muldoon, you know, was very welcoming, and Betty McMahon was very welcoming. So I was boarder's mistress at the time at King Copeland, and that was going to close down as boarder's. So I used to come down and do a remedial reading at Sadler on Mondays and Fridays.
Can you talk about what year this was?
This was 1969 and 70, or the end of 68 and 69, because I think it was 1970. I don't know whether I asked Betty or Betty asked me, but anyway, she said she'd like to have me on the staff. So that was the beginning of a lovely, lovely time. And she gave me 22 picked kids from years 2, 3, and 4 who were not performing, and put them all in a classroom and said, there you are, Nikki. I looked at the textbooks and things that they had, and I thought, oh, this is absolutely dreadful, you know, I mean, hopeless, no wonder they're not learning anything. And she was wonderful. She was really patient with me while I sort of got things going. And I had only one rule, and that was, you will not go out of this classroom, whatever you do, unless I send you to run around the yard. And so I never had a kid sitting outside the room like all the other teachers did. And very shortly, nobody else had kids outside the room, nor did they send them around to Betty anymore. If Nikki can keep that bunch in her classroom, they weren't game to, you know, to do that. And it's because we were not giving them experiential teaching. I mean, we didn't have the stuff to do it with for a start. And Betty was very aware of this. And so I had a wonderful time after the first term was hell, because it was really very difficult. But she put up with it, and lovely Jenny Harpley, who had the classroom on the other side, and she put up with the noise.
Can you describe some of that, of what that hell was?
Well, these children were not used to sitting down and doing work. And I would sit them down and I would say, now you are going to do this. And of course I had to prepare it all myself. And you can do this. And you are going to sit there and do it. And so I had a lot of preparation getting stuff done. And we did a lot of work where they actually were actually doing things, you know, acting, and I mean, we'd read something and then we'd act it, and we'd everything was done with energy. And I had I started with words and colour, and you know, so we'd all be out there looking at the charts, and so there were a lot of noise. And Betty said, well, of course, you know, art's completely out. Well, of course, art was completely in, because she said there'd be paint all over the place. And so After a very little while, I put paper all over the floor, and we had paint, and they were all over the floor, and there was plenty of mess, but there was complete quiet in the room. And I opened the door into Betty's room, and I said, "Come in quick and just look." And she was lovely. She was very good to me, and I put up. We tamed them, and they stopped throwing things out the window, and they stopped, you know, banging around.
How did they touch you then? Like, what touches you about them? That was the start of it, obviously, quite a journey.
Absolutely, yes. And they got
What was going on for you then?
They got reintegrated. Well, I had seen that this was a need and that something needed to be done. And because I do have that creative energy, and I think one of the things that was happening, you know, when I was looking after the house, was that my creative energy wasn't being used. And that's another of the reasons why eventually I just and I thought, well, this isn't not what religious life's meant to be about at all. Because we've all got feminine creativity, and it's got to come out somehow. And there's a huge field to be creative in, but the system was very clamping at that time. But it's sad, of course, we broke out of the system because we were all out there doing a real job, and it was only people who wanted to do that who survived out there. So we were all very united in our efforts.
So the real job was...
The real job was to find out what the children knew, what interested them, and how to teach them through their interests. And we succeeded, you know. And Betty was on about it, and then all the staff gradually became more and more on about it. And we created a lovely school and got rid of the desks and then Sir, you know, what was his name?
Ted,
yeah. And Ted came in, that was marvellous, and we got the playground going and, you know, and we had ducks and geese and rabbits being born and fish and we started Words in Colour with charts all over the place, and I had mathematical charts with... and a lot of visual stuff and a lot of for the ones who were less academic.
So they were stimulated. So they were an opportunity.
They were stimulated, yes. And everybody benefited from it. And I had learnt at this one-year course that I did that this was the way to go for all children. And that is one of the big things about working with intellectually handicapped people, that is where you discover... And then you find that everybody adopts it, because that's the way people learn.
So you were expanding, probably for the first time. I mean, I'm not trying to be. I'm just thinking about. I'm just hearing you, because I remember seeing you at school, and you were always this kind of tall woman, almost skipping around the playground sometimes.
Yeah.
Like I just kind of, you never taught me, but I remember seeing you a lot. And you're always very smiley and very open and, you know, quite a character, really. Very expressive, particularly in your face and your arms and your legs.
Yeah. Well, you see, that's who I was. And so Betty allowed me to be who I was.
So we're going to go from who you were, because I've just described what I've seen. If you want you to tell me what...
Yeah.
So who were you then? What were you expanding in?
Well, it was a release, because I was creating a type of education that I believed was what St. Madeleine Sophie and what I had experienced as a younger child when we were small classes and not exactly like this, but that was doing what we were wanting to do. And not everybody is academic. And thank God, because I've lived with all these academic nuns, and, you know, I mean, They're useless.
And what about the person you arrived at Saint Therese? What sort of person were you on arrival, and what was, and how did you evolve there?
Right. Well, I had had this wonderful year with these other women. Some of them were middle aged, had brought up a family, and some were young women who, maybe they didn't have enough qualifications to do a teacher's course or hadn't been accepted or something. And mostly they were ones from the country, younger people who thought they'd like to work in the special schools around the country. And they were a lovely bunch, you know, and they were sort of full of beans. And the teacher, who was an Englishman, he was very good, and he taught us all, treated us all as grown-ups, and we had wonderful discussions with him, and wonderful opening out of the whole business of education. And I thought, this is all the principles of St. Madeleine Sophie. This is what she wanted. And there they were asking me about the spiritual thing, and that was St. Madeleine Sophie's thing, you know, teach them the faith, teach them
who
to love.
St. Madeleine Sophie?
St. Madeleine Sophie is our foundress, who was born in France in, just before the French Revolution, in a little country town called Joigny, and was educated by her brother, who was training to be a priest, wanted to be a Jesuit priest, and he was teaching in the local school, and he thought his little sister was very bright, and he taught her. And so instead of being just a young peasant woman, she grew up as a really educated woman. And there were no nuns around France at that time, but she had this desire to be a Carmelite, to be a contemplative. And with this brother Louis, who was in touch with Jesuits and people who wanted to be Jesuits, and they said, look, we need women religious who are educators, and that's what's needed now after the French Revolution. And so she accepted that that's what she should do. And a few people sort of joined her.
And you identified with that? Strong.
Yeah, I identified that very strongly. One, because she gave us French spirituality, which was my spirituality through my family, which is an open type of spirituality, and an exploratory thing. So, you know, you've got your Jansenists who go the wrong way because they're exploring and it goes wrong, and you've got all your saints who are French saints and who start religious orders and start things up and, you know, do good stuff. But they're all fairly original, and so they usually get into trouble with the church and, you know, live through that.
Okay, so St. Therese.
Yeah, where are we now?
I'm going to bring you back to St. Therese.
Yes, bring me back to St. Therese.
What was your initial, you were contemplated, when did you become an apostolic? Was it in the early 70s or something?
No, we were always apostolic and contemplative. Now, because St. Madeleine Sophie wanted to be contemplative, she was told by the church that we had to be enclosed, right? And so we did not go out. And the children came to us, and the bishop said, well, you can have boarding schools and not parish schools because, you know, you're enclosed, right? And so I lived the first 25 years of my life as an enclosed religious. Now, I went to Sadler after Vatican II, and at Vatican II, they didn't say much about nuns at all, but they said three things. They said, see if you are living according to the scriptures, gospels, go back and see what your foundress has wanted, and read the signs of the times. And of course, the poor curia at the Vatican All the nuns started doing this, and so they went back and they had a look, what did the foundress want, etc., etc., and they all started, you know, moving into a different format.
How was that transition for you?
It was extremely hard because people did not understand. We didn't understand ourselves. We simply knew that we were losing touch, that it was not right, that something was wrong in the system. Now, when we went to Sadler, I mean, we were free women out there. Nobody cared what we did as long as we did a good job. We were in a parish. We were allowed to go out. We still wore a little habit, which was okay. We were out of the black. I don't think we were ever in the black at Sadler. And we understood that it was quite a good thing to have a little bit of a habit because there wasn't much sign of faith up there, and there were all these wonderful Catholic families around, you know, who wanted their kids to be brought up as Catholics, and there we were able to create something that was right for there, but that was good education, so that the bright kids could learn, and so the other little kids could also become worthy citizens, and we had all this wonderful relationship with the parents. So we were in clover, and we worked very hard, and we became very close to each other because we were all focused on one thing. And I very soon found the families who had a child we weren't able to take in the school, you know, who needed other sort of education. And because that was something that I had been awakened to, all the special schools, I started, let me see. Yeah, and I had the knowledge, so I had the knowledge of how to do it because I had this basic education thing. Now, it's the same thing if whatever you're teaching them. And I started preparing children for the sacraments. And Father Muldoon was delighted, and all the priests around about were quite happy too, so I started doing that. And who did I have to help me? Well, I had the lovely St. Vincent de Paul people, who were happy to do it, and we had the youth club. And so I had, you know, the Kennedys helping me and various people. I'm jumping the gun a bit because at first I had to just do it myself. I had to go into the families. So I prepared a few children like that. But in 1974, because of my French connections, I heard that there was a conference going on in Rome on this very subject. And as I couldn't find anybody around except the Good Samaritan nuns at Norellen, where Cathy Donnellan went, who were doing anything, and the CCD didn't have a clue, and the Anglicans didn't have a clue, and the United Church didn't seem to know either, I took this to the Special Education Teachers Association, which I belonged to because I had been trained there. And they said, "Nikki, you're going, aren't you?" And I couldn't get anybody to say, you know, yeah, I should go. They said, "Oh, isn't that interesting?" But Betty McMahon and the rest of the community said, "Nikki, you know, what are we here for? If we don't respond to that kind of thing, and you've got all that's needed to do it." And the provincial was good. And the St. Vincent de Paul Society bought me a round-the-world ticket, you know, through Sadler. And Father Muldoon signed all my papers, because I had to have signed stuff that I had a job to come back to, or I wasn't allowed into America. And he said, "And then now you're going to leave me, you know, you're going to go away." I said, "No, I'm not going to go away. No." You know, but I'll come back hopefully with something. And I had 4 months, incredible 4 months, wandering around Europe, because I met people at the conference and knew who to go and see what they were doing, and particularly in France, where.
So it was like a study tour.
Study tour, yeah, but a sort of personal study tour, and I ended up in Canada and Chicago in the middle of winter, and I learned an enormous amount. And they said, well, this is the basics of it. Now you have to go back and translate it into the Australian context, which of course is what I wanted to do. And I came back and got started. And that's when, because I had been pretty much sent by the St. Vincent de Paul people, who said, well, at last somebody is looking into this, great. John Newman was one of the people, and several other people who really stuck by me and helped me. And
John Newton,
that, you see, what I learned was, you do not teach them as individuals. You create a small community. You bring them into the community, the people who need to be prepared, and you do it together. So 1 week, I would have a meeting with the helpers, and we would prepare what we were going to do, and we would discuss the last session that we'd had. And the next meeting, we would have about 10 people. So I'd have 10 helpers and 10 young, or children, they all were at that stage. And we went through 10-week program for forgiveness and reconciliation, 10-week program for Eucharist, 10-week program for confirmation. So it took pretty well a whole year. And it was beautiful. It was all done through symbolic work. So you took all kinds of symbols, like, water and the open flower, and it was all done pretty physically. Beautiful, beautiful stuff. And they were as good as gold when you took them into the church. They were surrounded by people they knew, as well as their families. We'd taken them all around the church. They'd got behind the altar. They, knew about the book. They knew about all the different bits and pieces that are used. And they had become part of, which is what's meant to be, the bread's meant to be about your loaf of bread, and the wine's meant to be because we drink, and the flowers are meant to be because they are beautiful and open before God. And the holy book, with the Bible and the whole thing. I thoroughly enjoyed doing that. And the years went by.
How long were you at St. Therese?
Well, I was there until, from 70, well, from 69, but that was only part-time, till 1978. And I was asked to go to Rose Bay and look after the primary school there. And so we had a very serious discernment with the people at Sadler in the community. And for a number of reasons, I thought, yeah. And one of the main reasons was, well, Betty and Joy, they said, you're not really a teacher, don't you? And I said, yes, I know I'm not a teacher, I'm an educator, but I do a good job. And you're not going to sort of stay here forever, you're beginning to get a little older. And I was getting deaf. And my deafness was getting quite not so good. And also, I knew that I was really destined to do a lot more work with intellectually handicapped people on the spiritual thing, bringing them to the church. And I thought, now, what do they need? They need they need, how do I say, people who have a bit of clout. And I'm being asked to go to Rose Bay, you know. And if I sort of go to them and to the parents and say, look, you know, yeah, I'm the deputy principal at Rose Bay, but I want to look after your kids. That gave me status. And I must say, in the back of my head, I really felt that was good. I had the experience of Sadler. I knew what I was doing. I knew it worked. I felt, well, look, you don't have a right just to stay at Sadler, and when you really need to branch out and do this.
I'm going to stop you just there. Do you mind if we go back to Sadler a bit, or do you want to?
No, we can go back to Sadler.
I just want to talk a bit more. That was great. Just want to take you back, and I want to hear a bit more about the community and about your experience of the community, the people. So I don't know, like, as opposed to how we're being represented, you know, in the media or whatever, the reputation of the area, how did that fit with your experience of the people in Green Valley? In terms of the spiritual community, where were your spiritual community? How was your exchange with the people? Did you grow to love us?
I loved it right from the start.
I'm trying to get to some of those qualities, what you fell in love with.
I fell in love with people who were thoroughly genuine in believing in the importance of God and their faith, the importance of family, the importance of their children, of hard work to get there, of helping each other. You know, all the things that I valued from my family and from the Christianity that I believed in. And they were all there in a little seed that was sprouting and growing in some pretty tough soil there at the beginning. You know, life was tough for everybody. We had the privilege to be there, and each one of us who were there wanted to be there. So, and we were working together. And at first we had Bloss, Sister Cummins, who used to do the cooking for us. And I know we used to go and do the shopping, you know, in the car. That was all before school, you know, we'd do the washing and the cooking and not the cooking. And this was all before school, you know, the amount of work we did before school. And we did all the cleaning in those early days. We were really busy. And we used to spend the weekends doing our preparation, more or less. I always had different ideas about what preparation was, and I wasn't very interested in writing out an account of what I intended to do, because I never knew what I intended to do anyway. So I was not Betty's best friend on that account.
How were your relationships in the convent?
Well, you see, they were very good. Betty was a very good leader, so she was very much the centre of it. But we were too far away from anything. We didn't have time anyway to have too many interests outside. So one of the things we did, because this was something that happened in the area, was everybody sort of had their little bets on the racing, okay? So on Saturday afternoon, we would have our little bets on the racing, you know, and which was the same as everybody else. I remember we started off with $5 each, and I survived the whole year on that $5 every week, you know. We got to know how to spend your money and you know, so that you were getting enough back to keep yourself going. And so it was great fun, and we would play cards, and other people in the other communities were quite jealous of us because they could see that we were happy with each other and that we could have fun together. And that was good. We did go out together and do things together in the little bit of time that there was. So, yes, I mean, I formed very good friendships with all the people who were there. And we had beautiful people because they were all really genuine, real people. And the parishioners, you know, all the parents, they were all such real people. And we loved them and they loved us, and we went to the dances and we interacted with them, and they helped us to do whatever needed to be done. And you didn't have any problems with them, teacher-parent talks, and I got, you know, brave enough to stand up there in front of them and tell them what they should be doing. It was so funny about their little kids and preparing them for school. And I remember this particular time, and I stood up there and I said, "Well," I said, "you see, of course, you know, you take them in your prams," because I could see them doing all this. And so as you go past all the a different car, well, then you read the numbers on the cars and you read the names on the cars, and you notice the different cars, and then you read the numbers on the houses, and then you start reading the names on the shops and all this. Of course, none of the parents were doing this, you know. But all these things that help the children to be interested in figures and interested in words and things like that. So there was a fantastic thing. We were learning about life from all these wonderful families, and we could help the thing to happen. And the kids were happy at school, so that was a help to the parents. And it was a happy school.
How important was this time, what you, in hindsight, where you're at today, how important was that experience for you in terms of
It was
your life?
extremely important because I became myself again after the rigid sort of training that we were in. But everybody else was, you know, and plenty of wives were also living this with their husbands. So it wasn't a big deal. But there was a release from that. And when you have that release and can become a happy person, you can help other people to also feel released. And I've spent the rest of my life doing that, encouraging and helping people on with their lives. And that's why I say I am a good educator, and I still am, and I still do it. And so I, you know, that was my blossoming time at Sadler, and I carried that away. And so it was a great sorrow to me when we left Sadler. And after I had, what did I do next after that? Yes,
Rosebank.
I was only at Rosebay for 2 years. They asked me to go for 2 years, and then I was told, because now you should go in and do your work full time, because you've got a calling to do this work, with people with an intellectual disability. And I went, you know, I can't do that. I can do it part time, but I didn't feel strong enough to do that all the time because it's very demanding.
How old were you now when you
Well,
did that?
by then, what was that? That was 1980.
We've got about 10 minutes to talk.
Oh,
Just
80
leaving.
to, and 20 24, so that's six, and I was 56. And so they said, well, you could do clinical pastoral education. I don't know whether you know that. That's a very stiff psychological and spiritual counselling course that you do while you're actually either working in a prison or in a hospital or something like that. And they take you right down to the bottom of yourself. And I was a bit scared because I knew that the bottom of myself was not much fun. But I thought, maybe I need to do that journey sort of consciously while I'm okay. And then I think I will be able to spend my time with people who are really living it tough. The provincial said I should go and do it down in Goulburn. And I said, of course, I said that was, you know, ridiculous. I didn't say it in those terms, but I said, I can do this in Sydney. Why do I want to go down to Goulburn? However, of course, I went down to Goulburn, which was a very fine thing because the House of Prayer was there. Now, the House of Prayer had all these young people who were looking for the faith, but the faith in a way that was suitable for younger people and not bounded by all the religious regulations of convents and nuns and all the rest. And I asked if I could stay with them, and having a great provincial, she said, yeah, you go down there and find out what the young people are thinking, you know, so you can go and live there and do your course. And so after the course, and in the meantime, I had from the, there was an Anglican priest at the psychiatric hospital, and he gave me 24 hours, and I used to go back to Sadler, and I would have the little training session, because I still had all these people that we were working with, and I stayed at the House of Prayer for another 3 years after that. And I didn't really know why I was staying at the House of Prayer, except that I needed some time to absorb this new training and this new way of looking at life and looking at faith and looking at everything. And it turned out that a number of the people who had been running the place, and I had become one of them over that year, moved on to something else. And so there were new people coming in, but there was not much stability there at the time. And I spent 4 years, each of which were quite different, but I met lots and lots of people who were open to the whole idea of welcoming everybody. And, you know, the nuns weren't into that really at that stage because they were too busy. You know, they really had their hands chock-a-block full, and it was still too rigid a system to do that. So we didn't ever have any people staying, handicapped people, staying at the House of Prayer because it was much too fluid. It wasn't the right thing. But we often had them staying for weekends and having groups. And so those 4 years launched me onto my new career, which became forming groups in the Jean Vanier tradition and with Jean Vanier, who had started back in 1964 in France with a few men whom he invited to live with him. And then his work of L'Arche, which is now international, started like that and had come to Australia. And there was another big association which was called Faith and Light, and that was for families to bring them together and to help them to celebrate faith and to be part of a parish and with their people with a disability. And so I worked in that, and I worked pretty much all over New South Wales, setting up groups, which took quite a long time to set up, and then following them through, because once you'd prepared people for the sacraments, well then, you know, they still need special friendship and
so you somehow carry them through that impasse.
You have to carry them and their parents, and then you have to carry the parents through the whole process of starting up residences. Where are my kids going to live when they can't live with me, or when it obviously is not good for them to stay at home? So then I got into that part of it, but always with the spiritual formation. And for the past 12 years, I was in Brisbane, and I helped to start a large community up there, and I was helping very much to train people who were working with people with a disability. You know, why were they attracted to this? Where did they get their strength from? What was the Christian ideal of it? And because I had had all this experience, I did that. And it blossomed. I went on doing it until I was 82. And I could still do it, and I was still relevant. And I kept saying, look, you know, you probably need somebody else to help. No, you know what you're talking about. You know, you understand us. You give us good stuff when you come in.
Well, you're still so clear and fresh.
And they kept me fresh. They stimulated me. I had to come in to them each week with something real. Not just pick up a book and say, oh, I'll tell them this or I'll do that. It had to be what I was working on, what I was thinking about. What?
Can you talk about something real? Like, for example. I'm just wanting to hear an experience of yours, that's all.
Okay. Well, then you need to talk about community. Because community is a very important value in the Society of the Sacred Heart. And the idea about community is not just to get a whole lot of work done. It's the process of living in community that is so important for the world, and more important for the world today. Because in married life, well, there is some attraction between the husband and the wife. I mean, what happens afterwards? Well, but there is a particular bond. If you join religious life, you find yourself with people who are attracted to God in a particular way, but we are not attracted to each other. So one has to learn to live with different people, and you do not choose the people that you live with. And so you become a little mini cosmos of different people who learn, because of the love of God and of Jesus Christ, to live with difference, and to try to understand each other, and to try to complement each other, and to give and take. And that is extremely maturing if you really take it seriously. But it is also a witness to the world that it is possible for the Serbs and the Croatians to live together, for the Palestinians and the thing. Not to change, not to become the same, but to somehow share the ground. So in the old form, it was all very regulated, and you had a superior, and she said what was to be done, and everybody did it, and that was right. The new format is you organise it among yourselves. There isn't any boss. I mean, there's a provincial, because there has to be somebody to keep the thing hanging together. But you're on your own, mates, in your little community, and you work it out between you. And it's not always three or four people who are friends. It is rarely that. And now it isn't even that everybody is doing the same work, because people tend now to have their own apostolate, because we came to the stage where we realised that we are in it with the laity. We are lay people. instead of being married, we have this vocation to religious life. But we are part of the whole fabric of the world and of church. And so the fact that we can and do our living together in one little house with very diverse people is extremely important for the world. So does that answer your thought about it?
That answers a lot more than what I was actually asking. That was beautiful. That was really important.
Well, that's what I've come to. And all my work with L'Arche, you know, where people actually live with people with disabilities. I never lived for any length of time because I'm an organizer, I'm a bring people together, that's not me. But I have spent, you know, as much as sort of 10 days, I think was the most that I ever spent, day and night.
Well, you said you're the troubleshooter, you're the mover and the shaker, you're the one that makes it happen, and then you move on and make it.
Yes,
that all the time.
Yes,
is that right?
Yes, but you've got to stay there with it for quite a long time.
Yes,
and help, and especially when you're starting, there's got to be somebody who keeps the people at it.
That's what I meant by you've got to hold them through the.
That's right.
You can't just kind of like they do in government, just kind of run a project and
no.
see you later and
that's
tick
right.
a box.
That's right.
You're actually got to take people through something more than that.
Yeah, that's right.
So
that's right.
At one point, at what point have you come to realise that you move on? Process?
Well, when I got to be 80 up in Brisbane, and I was asked to go to Brisbane, and 12, 14 years ago, Brisbane. But the work that I'd been doing here in New South Wales was set up, and it was okay. I could leave it. I could leave the families. You know, there were other people looking after them, and it was okay. It was time. I could go. And so I went up there, and I because the network is good, you know, they soon found out that I'd landed up there and was asked to join.
Can I ask just something? Can I interject? How do you let go and move on? How do you continuously, like, this is important for me now, like in terms of running what you do and doing, like, to know when to move on? Like I understand this nature of work. Mm. I understand this nature of work because I relate.
I explain it because...
And how do you keep your humility in all that process?
It makes you humble. It makes you humble. I think, and I put it in very human terms, I believe I have a very jealous God who asked me, you know, not to have a husband, not to have my own kids, but to give my love freely, and that he would give me love to love whoever, wherever, however. And once I have got a lot of sort of friends that I'm working with and people that I'm very comfortable with, and, you know, this is great, I really feel great with all these people, like I felt at Sadler, like I felt, I kind of get that call, okay, now, you come follow me. It's a sort of an Abraham call that keeps coming. And you just know that you've got to move on. And I never know why I've moved on, you know. What's going to happen down in Melbourne now? And lots has happened already. But in Brisbane, I knew that the L'Arche was going well, that there were people now working at it, that the other... association that I was working with going well, that they had understood that they need to keep doing the reflective work and all that, you know, and they were going to go on doing it whether I came in or whether I didn't. And I was running out of steam. And I knew that Brisbane was not the place where I should be sort of retired. And so I couldn't keep up with them. They were all younger people. And I was not going to have anybody I knew there when I couldn't run with the mob. And there was a reorganisation of the province at that time. And so we were needing to sell the place where I was with Sister Ursula. And it was time for me to move out of Brisbane for a number of reasons. And that was the time to do it. So I said, look, you know, don't count me in the Brisbane reorganisation. See if I fit in somewhere else. And to my surprise, I mean, I was hoping I'd get here, actually, because I thought I could do things from here. And I, you know, I thought that'd be lovely. I mean, this is my territory and I'm old now, and it would be great to reunite, and that'd be lovely. And of course, God doesn't ask me to do that. You know, God said, go to new territory. And as soon as I heard that, I knew, I just knew that that was right. I mean, I knew it was going to be real tough and that I was too old to do that, really, but that I still could, you know, that I'd done it before, I had the skills. I've also got a lovely family down there, but the point was they needed somebody down there. And they needed somebody who could fit into a situation that's not easy.
What is down there?
Well, back in 1956...
We're going to kind of wind up.
Yes, yes.
I've got to get some shots
yes,
of you.
Yes, after having started Sadler... before we started Sadler, we went out to the western suburbs of Melbourne, to Braybrook, which was a big migrant area opening up, and opened a school there. Okay, now, we're not running that school anymore, but we've kept a small... community there in that area, which is highly, completely migrant, Maltese, Italian, Polish, Vietnamese, etc.
So that whole wave of migration, really, from the Yugoslavs and the Italians to the new wave of the 70s and now the...
And now more new waves.
Sudanese or...
That's right, Sudanese, and they're all there. Okay, so we've got a small house, three-bedroom house, and there are only two people, and they really did need a third person.
That's you and Ursula.
And that's me. No, Ursula, no. She's up in Brisbane. She stayed up in Brisbane.
Pat Ormisham
and Aline Doherty. Aline Doherty is a Melbourne dyed-in-the-wool person, and she's been there in that area for a long, long time. And Pat fits down there, and she works with Sudanese people. And they are as different as chalk is from cheese, and I'm another different person. We've all done fairly independent things. We've got three fairly and we are a community, and it is not easy, but it's real. And I'm having a rest for a fortnight.
Work hard.
Mm. So,
So what inspires you these days, Sister? Sorry, Nikki.
Well, what inspires me is that that I have lived now. I've had, you know, the privilege of living with people who were living it tough and who've worked through tough times. And with a lot of people for whom, I mean, once you've got an intellectually handicapped child, you've got them for life. And beautiful, wonderful people, parents, and wonderful handicapped people who are not easy to live with. And so they have inspired me. And they're all God's children, and they all have an incredible message to give us. And we're not accepting that message, because we're not accepting them. They're still not in the churches. And I go down to this really good parish there where everything's happening, but there's no group for the intellectually handicapped there. And I slapped myself on the wrist and said, you are not going to start one. You are not going to start one, Nikki. You know, your time is up. You haven't got the energy to do that. You do the best you can in the little situation you're at and be a spiritual grandmother to the people. And now I've been there for 2 years. And so I'm beginning to be settled. They're beginning to know me. I'm beginning to know them. And there's much more apostolate there than I could possibly physically cope with. And I'm inspired because God has trusted me in my official retirement to still do a job that needs to be done. And I find that wonderful. And so I am growing. I'm still growing, you know, because I have to cope with the situation in myself all the time. And because of this life that I've lived, I have had to seek the help that I needed, and I still do. So that I keep myself stimulated. And
just winding up,
yeah.
And this is only the first bit of hopefully a few more bits down the track, seeing how much money I'll get to do more bits. Just thinking about just some... Who are some of the women in your life who are still so valuable to you? Or are there any, you know? Is Betty McMahon one of them? Is, you know?
Yes, of course Betty is, yes.
Like just thinking about some of your
friends. But you see, Betty and I have an incredible relationship. We don't need to see each other. We don't need to... hold each other's hand. We just have this knowledge of each other and this sort of... So I actually came and made a retreat with her last August because I was running out of breath, you know, and of course it was the most wonderful thing I've ever done because she knows who I am and we could just sort of talk and she's a wonderful spiritual director. She is good. And it's lovely to see her able to do that now and have the time to do it. So that's great. Okay, so she's one, but I have a huge number of men and women, and they're all over the place, which is a bit of a problem because I keep moving around. You know, there's this sort of one lovely man up in Brisbane whom I we can say anything to each other, and there's well, there's a number of religious of the Sacred Heart. You know, I mean, I can say anything to Gilly, I can say anything to Veronica, or I can say anything to Joy. You know, we sort of know each other. There are people in Sydney. No, I've lost contact with Fleur. No, completely. But there are some people in Sydney that I can talk to any time. It's it's amusing because I have friends who are much more intellectual and intelligent than I am. I mean, I'm intelligent in a different sort of way. And we're great friends. Mm. You know, and there's a lovely one up there in Brisbane. But
experiential intelligence is so exciting, though.
I know. It is.
Never ending.
That's right.
So it's not restrictive.
Yes, and I have wonderful family. Wonderful family, nieces, particularly nieces, but also some nephews, and they're down in Melbourne, so they're a tremendous support. Lovely, and I have this wonderful chiropractor, kinesiologist, spiritual director, counsellor, who picked me up, and I had met him before in Melbourne, and he knows all the family. They all toddle into him. And he is the most complete alternate medicine man. He's learning all the time. He's just turned 50. And so he has brought me back to, he keeps me going. So, you know, I can't go in there and waffle on. I mean, he knows what's going on. And so he keeps me on the right track with what I need. And the provincial team are very good. They're very good. So I have to be sensible enough to say, I do need to go away. I do need to go see all these other people. You know, I mean, you may not need to do that, the other two. They don't understand why I need to wander around. And I don't wander around when they need me, because I don't do that. Yes, you see, I've got these contacts all over the place, and this lovely lady who came to see me, and often they're people who've I've picked up along the way who were in distress at the time, and we've become really good friends.